Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show. I'm Bruce Cameron. Justin will be back with us hopefully next week, and we have our special guest with us. One of our resident special guests, we might say, Mr. Jose Santana. Jose, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Bruce. Thank you having me.
Good to see you. Good to see you. Well, you know, we get a lot of requests. We talk to, between you and I, we talk to scores of people every week about federal prison issues, and it seems that we end up saying the similar things again and again and again, and we do it in different ways. And so today, what I thought we would do is take one aspect that is a very important aspect of the journey of the federal prison or the federal crime journey is the pretrial stage. So I thought we would talk about the pretrial stage and kind of focus some of that energy onto that stage. Now, I know there's a lot of crossing over between this stage and, let's say, the designation classification stage, because it sets the stage for the next chapter. But we did want to spend some time on the pretrial phase, because this is what a lot of our clients, a lot of our attorney clients are interested in. So, yeah, what do you think about that?
Absolutely, Bruce. Yeah. I think that many times individuals that are going through the criminal justice system forget the fact that they might have a good attorney, a good law firm representing them, and those attorneys that we have had the experience to are knowledgeable in the things they do. Sorry about that. That's my alarm going off. So, you know, they know the system, the court system, and they know the justice, criminal justice components that impact the sentencing of an inmate. And they have good legal representation, but they obviously forget what establishes the link to the Bureau of Prisons. And with the pretrial stage, the components involved in there and the basis of that legal interaction establishes the foundation of the classification system that the inmates are going to go through.
Right. And we often get retained too late. The cement is already dried. The pre-sentence report is done, and certain things can be addressed, and certain things maybe can't be addressed. So once the pre-sentence report is finalized, so well, let's kind of hit the ground running. The first one that we have, we talked about clear language, and the reason why, and I'll give my definition of that. And Jose, of course, you'll be able to. You need to clean up my messes today. So I'll go first and you clean me up. All right. But the clear language, right? The language needs to be clear so that anybody can understand it. A variety of different levels of BOP personnel, courtroom personnel, law enforcement personnel are going to be reading these documents. And as we know, the pretrial, the PSR is the Bible. It's the gospel. It sets the tone for the inmate's journey. And so it has to be very clear. If there is something that is not clear, you can probably bet that the BOP or whomever is going to assume more on the conservative side. So if the language isn't clear, that can present great problems. You know, we get calls all the time. Oh, my husband's a nonviolent bank robber. my husband's a nonviolent pedophile. I mean, some stuff's like, man, you know, you have to, that's a lot of education about what a crime of violence is. But, this domestic thing that happened 8 years ago, it was dismissed. So, you know, but if the language is in there. So anyway, so it has to be clear language. So if we can be retained early to look through the pre-sentence report and we see things that lawyers don't see, we see things that defendants don't see, because we're objective outsiders. And we were the ones left with the pre-sentence report for 5, 10, 15 years sitting there in the central file or sitting there, you know, that we have to go by. So, Jose, your thoughts on clear language?
So true. I mean, you mentioned that the cement is dry, once the PSR is done and the sentencing documents are all done. And it's true. And that's why some of the individuals, our clients and attorney clients, with their clients, get us late into the game once the cement is dry. And we're going to have to chip on it with chipping hammer. We've never seen a PSR being redone, actually.
Right.
In 26 and a half years, never saw. Maybe I saw one that had a clarification from a clarification letter from the sentencing judge and the chief USPO, but not a new PSR. So clear language has to be paramount to the narrative contained in the pre-sentence report, because that's what the Bureau is going to use to classify the inmate once he's inside. For security designation at the beginning of the stages with the DSCC, and then with the custody classification once the inmate is doing and serving his sentence inside the Bureau walls.
Absolutely.
Language has to be articulated in clear, plain language, because that leaves, you don't want to leave anything to interpretation, because it's going to be resulting in a scoring of conservative classification, which will tend to enhance the scoring system for the inmate.
Right. Which reminds me, a lot of people, they've been rescoring pattern risk scores. A lot of people's levels have gone up because of certain things in their custody classification, like adjustment programming, or even a 300 series incident report. But we'll get to that later on. I'm sorry, I digress. The next thing, so speaking of clear language, the next thing is citizenship. That has to be made clear. Are you a U.S. citizen or not? And, we've had a couple of cases where it wasn't clear. You know, the person obviously had an ethnicity that wasn't, necessarily American right off the bat type of thing. And it wasn't clear. And we have rescued several people from the clutches of one of those immigration private facilities. So, Jose, talk about how, you know, you don't take anything. Even if my name is Bruce Smith, I could be an alien from Scotland or something. So, you know, make sure that we have the citizenship nailed down. Right, Jose?
Absolutely. You know, that's clearly, you know, you cannot assume anything. You cannot have a pre-assumption of citizenship, because that's not the way it's used. If it's left vacant, then let's say it's a white collar offender, first time offender, and the U.S. citizenship is not established, and the individual is a U.S. citizenship, it will result of that individual having a public safety factor of a non-U.S. citizen that categorized as alien, and then they'll go to a low security facility without any need to do that. So do not just assume anything. Don't leave anything blank. Establish clearly if it's a citizen from the United States or a citizen from where, or non-U.S. citizen. Yeah. Or naturalize U.S. citizen for that matter, if it's a non-U.S. citizen or resident, permanent resident alien with a green card, or, you know, establish the residency in any which way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And hopefully I'm still here. So, yes.
I see you now.
How many times have we had people say, well, you know what? I've been in this country for 15 or 20 years. I have kids in this country. I'm a green card holder. I mean, I'm good, right?
Yeah, and that's what they assume, that they've been living in the United States legally with a green card and have residency and have a history of home and a history of employment, a family here. But that doesn't mean anything once you go to prison and go to the Justice Department. We'll have to include you in the determine if you're going to be deported or not. It doesn't matter. Unless you're a naturalized U.S. citizen and is established in the pre-sentence report, and there's no other way that you will be exempt from going through that process. You will be going through the immigration process to determine if you're not going to be deported.
Exactly. So we got to get that cleared up. And because if there's any gray language, there's always going to be an assumption made. And like you said, you jump immediately. There's consequences for that. Jumping immediately to a low security institution or possibly a non-mainline institution. So make sure that your citizenship is squared away. Well, our next point, and one of my favorite points about the PSR and some of these documents is to, and we get into this with attorneys a lot as well, but here it goes. Do not seal these documents. Do not have these documents under seal. Why is that? Well, because in 2020, just about everybody and their child has a PACER account or has the wherewithal to track some of these proceedings. They're electronically stored. They can be accessible through PACER and other means now. And if it comes up that, you know, you report to prison and you come out of R&D with your little white sack of property and people have researched you and they said, whoa, why is your stuff sealed, man? Why can't we find you out there, man? What's the deal? Are you you a sex offender or something? Or are you a rat? You're a cooperator? Did you roll on somebody? So, and man, that's just not a good first day in the joint once you hit population and you got people, inquisitive minds kind of poking at you about why this and that is sealed. So what are your thoughts on that, Jose?
Absolutely. And not only that, not only the inquisitive minds out there that are going to review your case.
Ah, the case manager. What's the case manager going to do when they see that?
Classification system. Not only the case manager. Let's go back. Let's peel it back to where the stage of the designation process begin. So if it's sealed, it's sealed for everybody. The Bureau, it's sealed for the Bureau of Prisons.
Sure.
Too. They
true.
Don't get privileged information. If sealed, it's sealed. And so they don't have that information. So guess what's going to happen? It's going to be, you're going to be scored at a higher security classification because they're going to be your security points, your security classification, and subsequent designation to a higher security facility because they don't have the information. So Bureau plays it safe.
That's right.
Happen. So don't purge information.
Seal or seal don't it.
Seal
information. Under seal.
Provide the most accurate, up-to-date information because the inmates are going to find out anyway. So if it's sealed,
right.
They're going to say, "Oh, he's a chomo, child molester, or sex offender, or he is an informant, a snitch, cooperator, or what have you, or he's in bad standing with his car, like they call it, his gang or his security threat group, or what have you." So it's bad. In every way around to seal information from the sources and to the sources that are going to classify you.
Absolutely. So once again, don't have the information sealed. All right. Everything goes crazy at showtime. All right. So our next point we want to talk about is medical history. Medical history, a person's medical history is really important, particularly now in a COVID post-COVID era or a CARES Act release era, compassionate release era, reduction in sentence era that we're kind of in now. And so, you know, that's where the clear language and clear medical history collide. Even if you're a 23-year-old seemingly healthy young buck or whatever. If you have asthma, if you have a medical condition, you have dyslexia, we talk about that later on in a needs assessment rubric, some sort of a, we'll talk about mental health in a minute, but your medical history is very important, and to have that clearly delineated in the pre-sentence report is crucial, because it can really come back and save the day. We've seen that. We've had clients that might not have been on home confinement like they are right now had we not drawn attention to the authorities some very salient pre-existing conditions that really intersected well with the CDC guidelines and COVID risk factors, et cetera. So, and thank God, you know, for some of the documentation that we had, because it's a little bit more of a stretch to later on. You don't want to be like, oh yeah, I was actually sick with this. And we get all these medical records in and we try to get into the institution and they have to verify it. And are these accurate records? And it just looks sketchy as heck to have medical records come in. That's my opinion. I don't know, Jose, you might have another opinion, but to have, you know, all this stuff come in ex post facto. We used to get that with RDAP, like, oh yeah, the person was a dope fiend. And then no, you know what I mean? Like if that wasn't in the PSR when it was written, no, you know what I mean? So, but with other medical conditions as well, particularly the era that we're living in with COVID 19 and CDC regulations as they are. Jose, what do you think about medical history?
You know, many of the PSRs that I've seen in this area of medical history, mental health, they lack the most of the information. And like you very well said, Bruce, they want to afterwards, the individuals want to, he or she want to present other supporting documentation to their conditions, and it's too late. Because the Bureau is not going to take it. The official source document, the core document, is the pre-sentence report. And like the legal maxim says it, if it's not included, it's excluded. So if you don't include it in the pre-sentence report, it's excluded from the pre-sentence report, it's tough luck. They don't care. You know, it's simple.
Right. Never happened, yeah.
A young man, 23-year-old, using an inhaler. Just that little simple fact shows that he needs an inhaler at times, or he's asthmatic and he needs the inhaler to breathe sometimes when he gets an asthma attack. So, and you know, from a security standpoint, once you're in the prison, if you got an emergency situation where you need to use chemical agents, and you know that the inmate has an asthma condition. Right. You're right. Not going to use chemical agents because then you're liable, unless it's really an emergency. Right. You have to use it. Right. But if you know that beforehand, then it alerts the administration and the management of the institution. You want to play it safe from all angles and include the information that is necessary and that is basic to that individual. So medical conditions, mental health conditions, are used to classify the inmate, and it assigns a care level at both levels.
Before, just you know, I want to underscore, you know, can the person walk around or not? Is the person in a wheelchair or not? Even the 23-year-old with an inhaler. There's the albuterol inhaler, but then there's other inhalers that have a steroid in them. They have like a prednisone steroid in them. Well, man, if you're on an inhaler that has the steroid, that's more of a severe respiratory situation than just the albuterol. Both still count. Both are still valid. But we've seen cases where, look, you know, this person is on a steroidal inhaler inside the joint. You know, that's pretty meaningful information right there. And so that can make a difference. That can make or break a situation. It can, you know, get you higher up the COVID list, or it can, you know, there's on a COVID review, that's a factor that can help you with early release. We've had guys, if they were walking, you know, somewhere in a wheelchair, and okay, but some of them weren't in a wheelchair, but they were in their 70s, you know what I mean? And we were able to underscore, some of the health risks for COVID given their age. And it wasn't easy. I mean, we prevailed, but Jose showed great patience. We showed great patience, and Jose showed even more patience as these individuals kind of rolled out of their respective camps and whatnot.
I tell you, we had individuals that were permanently attached to a wheelchair. They could not walk because they were paraplegic or quadriplegic. Older individuals that they required a walker, and that was omitted from the pre-sentence report. There was nothing anywhere. When we get this guy at the institution, we can't do nothing with them because they it was an older facility or a high rise that needed, you know, some heads up that this guy was coming with a wheelchair to make some accommodations. So really, those are assumptions that were made in those cases that were really detrimental to those inmates.
Yeah, I mean, we gotta hopefully, I'm hoping we'll be visual as like gunshot fragments in the lumbar, like U.S. Marshals prisoner waiting for transfer.
Yeah,
the guy's like, how in the world has this guy been in transit this long with this kind of medical type of stuff? So, but it happens, you know, and hopefully we're going to have a celebration show here in a few weeks or a month when this individual arrives at the institution that truly meets his medical needs. So anyway, okay, then enough of that. Next thing is mental health, the person's mental health, you know. Don't sit there, have a pre-sentence report, and under the mental health section, it says nothing. But then once you get to the institution, you're talking about post-traumatic stress disorder. You're talking about major depression and all this and that. And nothing was there. So once again, if you have any mental health conditions or concerns, please at least talk about those during the pre-sentence report. It's helpful if before the pre-sentence report is done, if whatever assertions you have in your mental health history that can be substantiated by a licensed mental health practitioner, whether that be a psychiatrist, psychologist, counselor, marriage and family therapist, social worker, licensed chemical dependency counselor, licensed sex offender treatment provider. So those are your major food groups of people who could substantiate a mental health diagnosis or issue. Having that in there can really make a difference. I have been myself, I was in a small medical camp as the only mental health practitioner. And I was pulling my hair out, man. You know, these guys had, some of these guys we got designated to us had way, you know, they needed to be in Butner or another place with a bigger psychology staff. Conversely, I was TDY at Big Spring, Texas, kind of one of the few people standing in that department for a while. And gee whiz, man, all you're doing is crisis management and then psych screenings. And we just don't have the resources in some of these places to deliver a lot of mental health facilities. And the Bureau knows that. And so if that's documented and the BOP knows that there are some mental health needs, they will get the person, generally, they will get the person to a facility where those needs can be addressed. Jose, your thoughts on mental health?
Mental health is a big, big issue in correctional management, particularly if the individual, if she or he is in a detention facility, they have psychiatrists, some of them, they have psychologists, some of them are equipped, some of them are not. I mean, it's a 50-50. I worked at a detention center and we had some serious mentally ill individuals, male and female. And they need it. They require more attention than what we had. And we tried to give them the attention we could. But they were a handful. And most of the attorneys didn't even tell us anything about it. They just dropped those inmates and came in to see their inmates. And their inmates were, I mean, a suicide watch, for that matter. Or being watched in the hospital because they were stranded to a bed because they hurt themselves so bad. And it was serious. Once, you know, they get designated, it should be clearly stipulated in the pre-sentence report, the mental health concerns. particularly if the individual had had serious bouts of suicide attempts, recent suicide attempts, and mental health history of mental health issues should be documented and well established in the pre-sentence report.
Absolutely. Absolutely crucial aspect of mental. Let me add this one thing. Mental health and substance abuse used to go together, but substance abuse on many writers is a separate section. So if you have a, we say this again and again and again, if you have a substance abuse issue, it has to be documented in the pre-sentence report. Otherwise, you cannot get into RDAP. You might be able to take non-residential stuff, but you can't be able to get into the residential program. So again, you want to show that your substance abuse problem mirrors the DSM-5 criteria, that you had a substance abuse issue at or before, certainly the point of arrest and those things. So that is also very important. All right. You have anything on substance abuse, Jose?
Well, substance abuse is, as you very well say, you have to establish that and document it in the pre-sentence report, which is the official documentation. Anything that's out of the pre-sentence report is at the discretion of the authorities to take it and to use that information to verify it. It has to contain that information in the pre-sentence report and establish the history in order to qualify the individual for substance abuse treatment, be it non-residential or the residential, which has the benefits of the reduction in sentences and the community transitional services component in the community. So it needs to be established clearly in the pre-sentence report.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, the next thing we want to talk about, and this is so important, and it's one that slips away all the time, it's verified education. And so I'm going to go ahead and defer this one to you, Jose, because you really know about how important not having verified education and what the ramifications are on the classification, the points, and that can make or break the difference on a custody level. But go ahead and explain that.
Well, verified education needs to be established again from the get-go in the source document, the core document, which is the classification document used by the Bureau of Prisons to classify an individual, which is the pre-sentence report. It needs to establish if the individual has a high school diploma or a graduate diploma from a college or university. It needs to be indicating verified by the PO who writes the probation, the pre-sentence report. And sometimes that's not mentioned, and it's unclear if the individual completed a high school or has a graduate diploma. So they have to go through the GED process, and they say, well, I have high school. I am a graduate from university such and such. Well, show me the proof, and then they'll have to request from the families an official transcript sent into the institution that verifies that. But that's clearly established with an easy language, verified GED, verified diploma of bachelor or doctorate or master's, whatever the case might be. It has to say that it was verified by the probation office.
Verified education. Right. You just can't, you know, just say, yeah, I did it. It has to be verified. That's the other step.
And simply put, Bruce, like you mentioned, it's 2 points deduction or 2 points addition. If you don't verify it, it's a 2-point deduction, which can mean the difference between going to a minimum security or low security, or from a low to a medium, or from a medium to a high. So,
right. And I've seen it in pre-sentence reports where they'll say, John Doe states he graduated from high school at Happy Hills High School and went to community college, but this has been unverified. Right. So it's in the PSR, but it's not verified. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that can be a problem when people don't execute that the whole way through. So all righty then. The next one is if the person was a cooperator or not. Okay. If they're a cooperator, are there separatees? You know, is it a conspiracy? Are there multiple people in the case? And if there are multiple people, if they were a cooperator, that brings up a lot of concern. So, Jose, I'll let you kind of talk about some of those. You're more familiar with the cooperators.
Many times they get a reduction in the sentencing guidelines enhancements, saying the substantial cooperation or what have you. If they cooperated, they cooperated. You can't take away from that, especially if they got a 5K1 reduction or cooperating because they pled guilty and they agreed to cooperate with the arresting or the prosecution or the arresting authority. So, I mean, if it's established that you cooperated, you cooperated. That's, you can't get away from that. And you have to clearly state it in the pre-sentence report. And then cooperators have issues in prison. You can't go around that. And inmates are going to know because you either testified against them or they arrested them because they know that you snitched, that somebody snitched them out. So that's the issue with that. You can't get away from that. You can't get away from that. You're going to have to establish the best way you can, but you want to articulate also because then your authorities that they need to safeguard your well-being and they have to protect you from, what might come down the road.
Exactly. So that is good. That is good to know. And that's going to present a lot of management issues, whether or not they're on their own or whatever. So we have husbands and wives. Sometimes the wife goes first, the husband goes second. There's kids that may be involved. We have family members, right? Cooperate or not. Sometimes we've had we've had two men that were married to each other, right? And yes, possibly, and that was an interesting situation there. So, getting these things lined out is very important.
And the particular thing about those two guys that were married, legally married to each other, where they were separated amongst each other.
In the same building, right?
Same building. And they were separated.
Right. So, okay, the next one we want to go through is, I guess, let's look at sex offender. The reason why I want to look at the sex offender, there's, seemingly a solid double-digit percentage of new inmates coming into the Federal Bureau of Prisons that are sex offenders, right? Contact or non-contact sex offenders. And so we get a lot of calls from sex offender clients, attorneys, and family members, particularly the non-contact types, to say that they're not violent. Well, quite simply, that's just not the way it's written. If you're convicted of a sex offense, you're precluded from certain BOP benefits, right? One of them being early release, another on different types of programs. Also, you're precluded from the ability to be in a minimum security camp. It's just unless something changes, it's just not going to happen. And so having that, I mean, how many calls have we had? Oh, but he's nonviolent and he's 76 years old and this and that. Like, hey, it doesn't matter. It's just the type, the categorization of offenses. Anyway, so what are your thoughts on sex offender, Jose?
It doesn't matter, really. There is no differentiation between contact sex offense and non-contact sex offense right now in the Bureau of Prisons. I was part of a work group and I was the chairperson of the classification committee for the classification system. And we tried to differentiate contact and non-contact. Still, that's in the ink pad. It's coming. I think it's something that's going to be reviewed down the road. But the fact is that there is no differentiation. The inmate who has a sex offense, which a conviction is not required to be classified as a sex offender.
Thank you for bringing that up. Please explain that.
A conviction is not necessary. Let me repeat that. A conviction of a sex offense is not necessary to be classified as a sex offender within the Bureau of Prisons. The public safety factor of sex offense will apply anyway. So, which means the individual, she or he will not go to no less than a low security facility if they have a public safety factor of sex offender. And certain benefits will not be applied to those individuals, such as First Step Act, earned time credits, those things. They will not apply to sex offenders. Another thing is the RDAP 3621E eligibility criteria will not apply. They cannot go to that. There are certain states that do not accept sex offenders in RRCs, in reentry residential centers, also known as halfway houses, because of that classification. So it is important. And needless to say, if it's a sex offense and a conviction is not there, you need some help to navigate how you're going to be classified in order for you to be placed, because there are some places that simply sex offenders will not be tolerated and will have a hard time living in general population. And that's something that the authorities need to know, classification authorities need to know for security purposes.
Right. And again, I want to be clear. Let's say a person had a prior offense, that the conduct of the offense was sexual in nature. Let's say it was aggravated sexual assault between a domestic couple, but then they dropped the case. They got zero criminal history for it, but yet, you know what I mean? The conduct's still there.
Right. In that example, let's say they dropped the sexual aggravated assault charges, but they have a minor assault. The underlying offense, the underlying conduct is sexual in nature. Right. So therefore, the conviction is not necessary as a sex offense. You were convicted anyway of a minor assault, but underlying offense was aggravated sexual assault, which was dropped because for technical legal reasons. That in itself, it's a classified as a sexual offense, and a conviction was not necessary for that purpose for the Bureau to classify the individual as a sex offender.
Absolutely. Wow. Well said. And that happens a lot. So we have people complaining, hey, I'm here for a drug conspiracy, but yet you're treating me like I'm a sex offender because something that happened in the past that I didn't even get really charged for. This is BS, this and that. Hey, you know, the facts are the facts, or what the words on the PSR, the conduct is the conduct that was allegedly executed. It's a tough situation, you know, Ed, but that's one of those things where, you know, a person's past really does catch up to them. And it can be a tough situation, and all of a sudden, they're precluded from some release benefits that they thought they were going to get. All righty then. Well, next one is a little bit friendlier. We talk about religious needs. And the BOP is somewhat sensitive to a person's religious affiliation and ability to worship with various forms of worship and denominations and religions. And so if there is a situation where somebody has particular religious practices, and that's, you know, delineated or that's explained with clear language in the pre-sentence report or even in the judgment and commitment order, which is another show, at sentencing, then the BOP can make recommendations or designation, possibly considering the religious preference. Jose, tell me some of your experiences with that.
Most of the PSR lack that information. Most of the PSRs don't mention anything about religion preferences of an individual. And that's very important, particularly in this days now, and the era we live, where, you know, the situation of religious sensitivity, and the Bureau tries to accommodate the individual's religious needs. Particularly, you know, you can't assume anything if, for example, you just say Muslim. So what kind of Muslim are you? a Muslim for the Nation of Islam, or just a straight up Muslim because you're from the Middle East, or, you know, or for example, the Jewish Jewish religion. You could be Hasidic Jewish, Orthodox Jewish, and some institutions don't have those services. So in order for the bureau to accommodate, they'll have to designate a place where you could accommodate that religion. So it's important, and it's been missing for the most part. When I provided training to probation officers throughout the nation and chief probation officers, we always wanted this area to be included, and some did, some improvement, but still, I would say conservatively, 90% of the probation offices missed this area in their pre-sentence reports.
They do. Okay. The next one is criminal history scoring. I know that's kind of a broad, maybe we should just say, I guess criminal history might be a better, that would be a better way to put this. Criminal history. So we kind of alluded to that with that sex offender example that might have had another criminal history. But, criminal history is an important, that is an important variable. And if there are mistakes in the pre-sentence report, reporting the criminal history, that needs to be remedied before you get sentenced. I mean, that has to be fixed if there's a problem. So criminal history is huge. It has huge ramifications on the future chapters of designation, classification, and then custody classification. Now certain things that are 10 years or older, hey, it might not take as much precedent if it's a super old crime, but some other things might last forever. So criminal history, again, and having that in clear language and accurate is very important. Don't try to hide anything, for God's sakes, because you don't want to, you're sitting there doing your time, and then all of a sudden, now this happens legitimately, and it happens sneakily, where then all these detainers pop up, right? And you're getting ready to go to home confinement. You're about ready to get out of prison early, and all of a sudden, you have these detainers and pending charges. So you want to get those, get those out there. And that way, you and your legal team, I say you, whoever, your legal team can address these pending charges and then get the states to show that they've dropped those proceedings, so that you can get out of prison early, so that you can participate in residential reentry centers, so you can participate in home confinement. So criminal history is just real important. Jose, what are your thoughts?
And criminal history is taken literally from the pre-sentence report by the Bureau classification authorities, be it at security designation at the DSCC, or be it at custody classification inside the institution once the unit team classifies you. So it's important to establish a clear, accurate custody classification score, criminal history scoring based on the sentencing guidelines and based on what the U.S. probation officer sees. You need to make sure it's accurate, because it's going to come with you the rest of your history throughout your incarceration. If it's incorrect, it's going to be hell correcting it. It's not going to be easy. Actually, we have an individual who's trying to contest it, and he thinks it's wrong. It was calculated wrong, and 8 points, and it should be 6. That's 2-point difference, which makes a significant amount of difference when you're scoring from between minimum and low. You want to make sure that is accurately scored, and it's taken literally from the pre-sentence report. In cases that there is no pre-sentence report, magistrate cases, it's taken from the NCIC. So you want to make sure that you don't deceive the probation office or don't deceive the sentencing authority, and make clear what you got. If you don't have any convictions and you say you don't have any convictions and they find out, then you're trying to deceive and be really untruthful about your history, and they're going to hammer you and they're going to enhance you. And they're going to put you in a bad situation with the sentencing court. Especially the judge will know, because probation will talk to the judge. So you want to make clear, you want to be accurate, and you want to have it clearly stated what your criminal history points are.
You don't want to make a false statement. Actually, making false statements is a famous federal charge. So you sure don't want to do it on that venue.
Not at that level.
So, yeah. And so, man, this was a great summation of the pretrial stage. Of course, you know, this culminates into the pre-sentence report. And then later when the person's sentenced, we have this statement of reasons and then the judgment and commitment order. And those are things that you can contact us about as well. We may have shows that really, you know, talk about those source documents. What do you call them? Sentencing impact documents. Well, and Marshall's 129. That's for another day, man. We're going to have at least some teasers out there with some of our not proprietary, but insider stuff that we know about. So yeah, good stuff. So, so folks, you know, thanks for, and Jose, of course, thanks for being on the show today. Just fantastic job as usual. Your expertise is just fantastic. And it's really important for our attorney clients and defendant clients to know this information, because just a lot of people just don't know it at the level. Certainly you know it, and they're just missing out on so much. So we're glad that we're able to at least bring some of these issues out in a public forum. So
I'm happy to share it with the folks and with you, and appreciate the opportunity.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. So, and again, feel free to visit our website at federalprisonauthority.com. That's federalprisonauthority.com. And all the services that we provide are there. Also, we have a Facebook group. It's a Facebook family of about 3,000 individuals, attorneys, defendants, ex-BOP inmates, former inmates. It's a beautiful family we have, and it's called First Step Act Federal Prison Reform. And it's on Facebook, and it's a public group. Just answer the questions that I have there and be nice, and I'll let you in. If you're not nice, I'll kick your ass out. So I don't put up with no bull. And also follow our YouTube channel. Folks, we have some fantastic videos that Josh and Andrew have produced for us on YouTube, more so Josh. So shout out to Josh for his work. And that's First Step Act is the name of our YouTube channel. So you have the Facebook family, you got the website, and then you know, got the YouTube channel. So you got your major food groups. Of course, we're on Facebook, Federal Prison Authority as well. And I'm on Federal Prison Authority on Instagram. So every now and then I'll bust out a picture on Instagram. So we got our pillars of social media. We'd love for have you to interact with us. We can always be reached at our email at federalprisonauthorybop@gmail.com. So with that, you know, we'll bid everybody a great week. Stay safe out there with COVID, and make good decisions. Protect yourself and others as best you can, as best you see fit. So until then, we'll see you here next week on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. Take care, everybody. Have a blessed week. Stay safe. See you next time, Jose.
Be well. Take care.
All right.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Justin Nimmergood, only on LA Talk Radio.